The other Florida is north and west of the tourists in the space age. It is unknown Florida, half the state, but it can be another country and sometimes even another world. This is the story of a journey there, a journey which began from place to place, went on through time, and ended among the people whose home and destiny the other Florida is.
The Other Florida. WFSU-FM presents a series of personal impressions of a little-known area of our country. Its past and present. Its land, people, and some of its music. A picture in words drawn for all America of its last frontier. Gloria Jehoda reads from her book, The Other Florida, an account of her impressions of this unknown country.
Chapter 13, The Music Maker of Solano Grove. As you go east toward the Atlantic Ocean, the other Florida becomes an ever-narrowing wilderness. Less and less of it extends into the peninsula. By St. Augustine, where rougher waves in the gulfs batter at grainy coral sand shores, you have entered national tourist territory. Billboards hawking suntan lotion, a fountain of youth to which you can buy tickets, and a chamber of commerce adept at collecting your dollars for everything from old jails and oldest houses to museums of hobbies. Yet a few miles west of all this ballyhoo, you are still in seldom-discovered country. On the banks of the St. John's River, Clay and St. John's counties knew their own heyday 80 years ago as meccas of would-be citrus tycoons. Usually the winters, moderated by the ocean, were mild. Occasionally, as settlers were to find, they could be frigid, and mature groves could be felled in a single crystalline night of hard frost. Today, orange trees along the St. John's are carefully sheltered patio plants. But before winter's hazards were fully appreciated, there were producing groves in the vicinity. Harriet Beecher Stowe tried her luck near the town of Mandarin, and turned from the strictures of Uncle Tom's cabin to bucolic nature essays. For another grove a few miles south, a different destiny was in store. Unknown to most Floridians today, it is famous in England and in Europe as a shrine not of successful orange culture, but as a landmark in the history of modern classical music. Frederick Delius, who died in 1934 at 72, was a highly original composer whose exact niche has baffled critics ever since. His haunting, bittersweet themes are unmistakable and unclassifiable. You love them or you hate them, instantly and forever. Born in England of German parents whose ancestry had been Dutch, he spoke in the broad accents of Yorkshire. Fascinated by Scandinavia, he wrote setting after setting of its tales. Tenaciously clinging to a privacy as complete as he could make it, he spent his closing years, blind and paralyzed, in the tiny French village of Grez on the River Loing, 40 miles south of Paris. Note by painful note, bar by bar, instrument by instrument, he dictated his last scores to an amanuensis. Whenever a reporter dared to knock at his door, he would bellow, "Tell him I'm out!" A citizen of Europe, the critics and his friends were fond of calling him. But when he knew he was dying, he chose the poetry of Walt Whitman for his songs of farewell. The last book he wanted read to him was Mark Twain's Roughing It. One of his favorite records was Old Man River, and when he was asked how he had decided to be a musician, he answered that it had happened on a grove near the landing of Picolata, Florida, while he was listening to Negroes sing on the east bank of the St. John's one hot summer night nearly 50 years before. If pre-Civil War New Orleans pianist Louis Moreau Gottschalk was the first classical composer to draw on Negro folk music, Delius was the first to use it in orchestral works played the world over. He anticipated Dvorak's New World Symphony by 15 years, and it was the tone poem Appalachia and its discords that first surprised Europe into a serious awareness of musical America in 1904, when a chorus sang out, "Oh, honey, I am going down the river in the morning. Hey-ho, hey-ho, down the mighty river. And don't you fret or cry. And you'll find me ever waiting, my own sweet Nellie Gray. Neither the concert-goers of Elberfeld, Germany, nor the town council had ever heard of Nellie Gray. They were upset. How could Herr Delius expect them to listen to such crude songs and harmonies? Today Appalachia still makes unusual listening. Not only are its flowing chromatic passages full of variations on Negro tunes, but every once in a while they are interrupted by snatches of string-picking that come close to the hillbilly zest of Lester Flatt, Earl Scruggs, and the Foggy Mountain Boys. The musical traditions of the Crackers are the same. Wilderness, Delius would muse. Once I was in the wilderness in Florida. I have never since been able to live long in a crowd. He was the first Old World composer for whom the Old World was no longer enough. He was also a lover of Florida who never forgot the steaming days and lonely nights he had spent in its woods and swamps. There he had become part of the lives of its people, Negro and Indian and white. And if the story of what he knew of them has been told, what they knew and still know of him has not. He was born in the drab industrial Yorkshire city of Bradford in 1862, the second son in a family of 14 children. His father, Julius Friedrich Wilhelm Delius, was a naturalized Englishman who addressed his wife as Madam and had rigid ideas about his sons having to enter his wool business. Delius and Company was rich and growing. Julius ran it as he ran his household, with the ruthlessness of a martinet. He was a patron of provincial music, but no musician was a social equal in his eyes. It was all very well for Fritz to want to go to concerts and play the violin, but as a livelihood, music never occurred to him. Fritz was sent to the International College at Spring Grove, Middlesex, to learn accounting and textiles, and from Spring Grove he was packed off to Saxony to begin working in a cloth factory. When Julius learned he was spending more time in theaters and concert halls than in the weaving rooms, he sent an irate telegram to summon Fritz home for a lecture. The episode was repeated in Sweden, France, and Manchester. The oldest Delius' son, Ernest, had already refused to have anything to do with Delius and Company and had fled to New Zealand. Back in Bradford, bored and dejected, Fritz began to spend long days in the family library, poring over maps of the world and foreign newspapers. At night, Julius roared at him across the dinner table, and his mother's full German face was pained and sad. In the middle of one scene, Fritz cast about his memories of the maps and some American advertisements he had seen. Abruptly, he announced that he had made a decision. What he really was meant to be was an orange planter in Florida. Julius was incredulous, and then, touchingly, optimistic. He had founded Delius and Company by himself as a young man. Perhaps Fritz was meant to found a dynasty of orange growers. Certainly Julius had heard Florida was a paradise on earth. Everybody had. That it was also as far from blustering telegrams as anybody could get may have occurred to him. But in time he could send some trusted employee to check on Fritz's progress. Then Fritz would be taken by surprise enough to make him stick to his oranges if he hadn't been sticking to them already. The Bradford representatives of a Florida land company boosted the upper St. John's River near the east coast to Julius in his office. He could rent a grove dirt cheap for Fritz and later buy it on terms that were a steal. Real estate in Florida was a gold mine. Fritz would grow rich in a land that knew no winter. There was nothing to harvesting oranges. You simply watched the fruit ripen and then had it picked by ex-slaves who would work for a pittance. The Civil War was over, and investors from all over the world were pouring into the South. Julius couldn't go wrong if he tried. Neither, even, could Fritz. By the time Fritz was visiting his favorite sister Claire at her boarding school to say goodbye, he was wondering what he had done. Florida was nowhere, an exile. Not even the company of Charles Douglas, the rebellious son of another Bradford textile manufacturer, would be much of a comfort. The nearest large city to the plantation Julius had rented by long distance was called Jacksonville, and it wasn't likely to offer much theater or music. For Fritz, there wouldn't even be the consolation of a Christianity which urged the young to honor their parents. When he was a child, he had watched a Bradford atheist in the market square challenging God to strike him dead in 2 minutes if he existed. God hadn't. Now Fritz had committed himself to backwoods because he hadn't been able to think of any other way of escaping his father. He knew what he didn't want, but he had no idea what he did. He adored women and music, but what they would be like in Florida there was no telling. In March 1884, he and Charles Douglas set sail on the Cunard liner Gallia for New York. From there they went by steamer to Fernandina, and then took the train to Jacksonville, a spreading expanse of wharves along the wide St. John's, where schooners were anchored to receive cargoes of oranges, turpentine barrels, and cotton. Tall palms shaded cobbled streets full of banana-laden pushcarts. Negro women walked with laundry baskets balanced on their turbaned heads, and dapper carpetbaggers who had stayed south flaunted flowered waistcoats, walking canes, and white spats. The cries of pecan sellers were mingled with the spring songs of nameless birds. The nasal twanging of poor white farmers in town to market their turnip greens, and the softly slurred speech of one-time Confederate officers. The smell of jasmine blossoms hung like an anodyne in the warm air. But the two young men had no time to linger. G.R. Pride, the owner of Solano Grove Plantation at Picolata, met them to sign a rental agreement in person and told them spring rains had made the road to Picolata impassable. They would have to go in by riverboat. When at last they stepped ashore, they were stunned into silence by what they found. The grove was overgrown. Huge creeper and trumpet vines coiled the branches of giant sweet gums and pines. Wild blackberries were spreading in thorny thickets along dilapidated fences. Spanish moss hung everywhere. Three bushy palms and a live oak with a spread of 90 feet stood in front of the shack that would be home. The shack had wooden porches in front and back, 4 tiny rooms where it was so hot you could hardly breathe, and a detached kitchen with a wood stove. There was no bathroom. A cedar-shaped roof sloped down to head height. Bees and dragonflies and wasps were buzzing in cobwebbed corners, and the smell of rancid grapefruits and oranges was everywhere sickeningly strong. The fruit, the size of footballs, said Fritz later, lay rotting under unpruned trees festooned in moss so thick in places their branches could hardly be traced. After a few hours, a young Negro who said his name was Elbert Anderson turned up with his wife, Eliza, and her younger sister, Julia. Off and on, they had been the only help on Solano Grove. The orange season was over. Maybe the young gentlemen's could find something for them to do until next year when the crop was ready. They surely hoped so. They were hungry. That night Fritz and Charles sat on their front porch listening to the murmur of the river and the buzz of the mosquitoes. Soon they were listening to something else. Banjos and African-tinged voices from Elbert Anderson's hut. He and Eliza and Julia were singing. Some of the tunes were vaguely recognizable as hymns, but Fritz had never heard hymns with such harmonies or rhythms. Anderson would take a tune and spin it into improvisations that were alien and exciting. Here was a music undreamed of and tantalizing, the music of ragged illiterates, which was a combination of sadness, nostalgia, and boisterous merrymaking. Charles went to his cot to try sleep, but Fritz stayed on to listen, smoking cigar after cigar, forgetting the shock of Solano Grove in the fascination of its tenants. The classic southern ingredients were all there. Moonlight on the magnolias, the heavy scent of mysterious wildflowers, chanting from plantation quarters, neglect and decay and profusion. The nearest road was more than a mile away. Frogs croaked, and mockingbirds ignored the dark to sing from hidden branches. All was the river lapped at the driftwood and sand along a narrow shore. The music from the hut continued. Hearing their singing in such romantic surroundings, it was then and there that I first felt the urge to express myself in music, Delius noted years afterwards. The urge may not have been quite so sudden, but it came with a strength that made rotten oranges and no plumbing unimportant. More than 30 years later, one of Anderson's spirituals was used by Delius in his double concerto. The world of Elbert Anderson became an obsession with Fritz Delius. He listened to stories of slaves long ago sold down the river, of ancient Spaniards like Mateo Solano, who had begun his grove, and the conquistadores whose armor had gleamed in virgin forests. With Anderson he learned to hunt the quail that had their coveys in tough, weedy thickets. One night Anderson roughly seized him by the arm with such force that his gun went off. He had saved him from stepping on a rattlesnake 5 feet long. Sometimes the crackers, poor whites who ate cracked corn, came by, and Seminole Indians, their coppery faces mask-like and unreadable. They, too, sang. Between Fritz and the crackers and Negroes and Indians, there was always a detached courtesy, yet all involved knew there was a bond. With Anderson and Charles Douglas, he spent nights of alligator hunting along remote creeks. Charles was anxious to clear the ground under the citrus trees, but Fritz hired another Negro whose job it was to teach his master everything he knew on the banjo for his violin. It was only in letters to Julius back home that Fritz offered any useful facts on oranges. If Fritz had been surprised by his jungle, he was also soon surprised by one of his plantation neighbors, Mrs. Charles Edward Bell. She was 5 years his senior, a Norwegian married to an Englishman who had also listened to the siren song of Florida developers and now owned the adjoining grove. Her cousin was married to a musician in Norway named Grieg. Had Fritz heard of him? Enthusiastically, Fritz said that he had. Jutta Bell confided her plan of teaching music in Jacksonville. She intended to take the professional name of Madame Bell Ransky, knowing her Americans and that they expected their culture to come from very foreign shores. Jutta Bell Ransky was a woman of parts. In later years, she turned to writing. Health, speech, and song, voice and nerve control, and even Revelations of Man, the Key to Invisible Laws. On a less sublime level, she founded the Jacksonville Little Theater and was active in a struggling music club. She recruited Fritz to play Schumann on the violin in overstuffed drawing rooms, where Jacksonville matrons were as enchanted with him as she was. But his first trip from the grove to the city happened when Charles Douglas developed a violent case of malaria and needed more than Elbert Anderson's home remedies for a fit of the shakes. A Picolotta friend, Mrs. Montgomery Corse, gave Fritz the name of a Jacksonville doctor. Yet when he reached the Bay Street riverfront address, the doctor was out. He left a note with a secretary and wandered into the nearby music store of Mary Day and Payne. Here he found a piano and found that it was for rent. Immediately he sat down to try the harmonies of the Negroes and Indians and poor whites of Solano. Soon he had forgotten all about Charles's malaria and had abandoned him to the mercies of Mrs. Corse altogether. He was intoxicated by his first American contact with a keyboard. When he heard a dry cough, he looked up to the gaunt face of a listener who demanded to know where he had heard what he was playing. "They're just tunes I was making," he explained. The listener introduced himself as Thomas Ward, organist of a Jesuit church in Brooklyn. He had been sent to Florida for his tuberculosis. Hadn't Fritz seen his advertisement in the St. Augustine Chronicle? "Learn to sing at sight. Thomas F. Ward, organist in the cathedral, has organized a singing class which will meet once a week. Those desirous of thorough instruction should join at once. A few pupils will also be received for private instruction in sight reading or on the piano or organ." Ward pressed Fritz for details about himself. Had he had music lessons? Did he know any formal harmony and counterpoint? Had he ever tried his hand at songwriting? Was he willing to slave day and night to learn the rudiments of music at Solano Grove if Ward moved in with him? The upshot of their conversation was that when Fritz returned to Solano, it was not only with a belated doctor for Charles Douglas, but with Ward. Soon the rented piano came upriver by barge, and an angry Charles moved out to find a grove of his own. The spindly tables in the shack were now littered with score paper. Ward established a strict schedule that left Fritz exhausted enough at night to sleep in the torrid heat of the rainy season. In old age, Delius told his amanuensis, "Ward's counterpoint lessons were the only lessons from which I ever derived any benefit. He showed wonderful insight in helping me to find out just how much in the way of traditional technique would be useful to me. And," thoughtfully, "there wasn't much. A sense of flow is the main thing, and it doesn't matter how you do it, so long as you master it." At Solano, he mastered not only a sense of flow and counterpoint, but the complex syncopations of his cracker neighbors, and of Elbert Anderson, his wife Eliza, and her sister Julia. They all sang on together as the rancid oranges and grapefruits slowly decayed into the leaf mold of a completely untended yard. A decade later, plantation choruses were to be a part of Delius's opera Cowanga, the first ever written about Negroes, and 30 years before Porgy and Bess.
Oh,
Delius was a methodical parent. He tried to believe at first that Fritz's increasing silences were due to the briskness of the orange trade. But when he did get a letter full of Fritz's enthusiasm for Ward and the piano, he decided it was time to send his agent, a man by the name of Sucksmith, to read an ultimatum. Fritz was to labor with the oranges, not music. Mr. Sucksmith at the last minute was unable to go, and a Mr. Tattersfield was sent instead. In a tale by Dickens, as one Delius biographer has pointed out, the names could stand as they are. Probably Mr. Tattersfield had visions of a sleepy Fritz debilitated by the tropics. Julius had even hinted at a fear that Fritz might have gone native. What Mr. Tattersfield found instead was a young man bubbling over with a furious energy, immensely vital and completely absorbed, playing the piano and scribbling counterpoint all day long. When he wasn't doing these things, he was on the river in a boat listening to Elbert Anderson sing slave songs. The horrified Tattersfield took one whiff of the rotten fruit and reported it all to Julius. Fritz unwisely chose this time to ask his father to send him to Leipzig, where Ward felt he could now be taught composition more fully. "No," thundered Julius, and sent a cablegram to Jacksonville. Yet when Mr. Tattersfield had left in defeat, who should turn up at Solano but Brother Ernest Delius, who had failed in business in New Zealand, taken to drink, and begun dreaming of easy oranges? Julius Delius now bought the grove outright in the hope of chaining Fritz to it forever. Airily, Fritz turned it over to the tenancy of Ernest, wished him luck, and left for Jacksonville. In July, an advertisement appeared in the Florida Daily Times there. F. Delius, teacher of the violin, Stephen G. Sesser, teacher of foreign languages, Bingham House, corner of Julia and Forsyth Streets. The print shop of Alexander Campbell was also advertising Zum Carnival, a polka by Fritz Delius, which could be bought for 60 cents. Unmarried Jacksonville girls were beginning to line up at Bingham House in droves.
The Other Florida, A Personal Impression of an Unknown Country, written and read by Gloria Jehoda. The Other Florida has been published by Charles Scribner's Sons and is presented for radio with their permission. These programs are produced by WFSU-FM at the Florida State University in Tallahassee.